Tehran slams as unfair and unprofessional recent comments by the IAEA's director general about the agency's limited visibility on Iran's nuclear activities. Russia says its recent missile strike on Ukraine's southern port city of Odessa destroyed a warship and weapons supplied by the U.S. to Kyiv. Plus, people in Tunisia are casting their ballots on a new constitution regarded as a referendum on present side's policies. Opposition parties have called for a boycott. I'm Behruz Najafi. Good to have you with us. Now, top story this hour, Iran saying it will not act emotionally and hastily over the talks for the revival of the 2015 deal. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani says Iran is serious about reaching a good and durable agreement. He, however, said Tehran will not sacrifice the nation's interests. The spokesman also criticized the recent remarks by the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency about Iran's nuclear activities. Kanani said that Rafael Grossi's assessments are unfair and unprofessional. He said Iran expects the IAEA to adopt a constructive approach in response to Iran's trust-building steps. Grossi has claimed that Iran's nuclear program is, in his words, galloping ahead, and the agency has very limited visibility on what's happening. A day after the arrest of a spy network in Iran, the Islamic Republic has released new details about a group which it says was linked to the Israeli spy agency Mossad. A source close to the Supreme National Security Council says that a team had planned terrorist and sabotage operations in several sensitive locations, including a center in Isfahan province. The network's elements received training for months in an African country and entered Iran through Iraq's Kurdistan region. They were in possession of advanced equipment and powerful explosives. The Iran Intelligence Ministry says that a team had placed their explosives in their targeted areas and was arrested hours before completing their terrorist operation. Israeli forces have killed at least two Palestinians and injured 19 others in a military operation in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. Resistance groups saying that the confrontations in the occupied West Bank prove the fact that a Palestinian uprising will not stop until the end of the Israeli occupation. Mona Kandil reports from Ramallah.
Thousands of Palestinians took part in funeral processions of Mohammed Azizi, 25, and Abdurrahman Subh, 28, who were killed early Sunday during an Israeli military raid in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus and its old town. The Fatah Armed Wing Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade says the two Palestinians were its members, while the Israeli military says the operation in Nablus was launched to apprehend armed suspects. Following the raid, a general strike called across Nablus to mourn the death of the two Palestinians.
The operation this time was more violent than the previous ones. Clashes were heavy as Israeli soldiers raided the neighborhood from all sides. Live ammunitions and rockets were fired towards the houses. I believe such ammunitions are only used in wars between countries.
Israeli forces raided Al-Yasamin neighborhood and surrounded a house, which the regime said Palestinian fighters had barricaded themselves in. Eyewitnesses described the raid as a full-blown military invasion, while the Palestinian Red Crescent reported 19 injuries, including 10 people, hit by live fire. The Palestinian leadership has condemned the operation, with a spokesman of the Palestinian president saying the Israeli crime will not defeat the Palestinians and will not break their will.
It's a barbaric act. It's another crime committed by the Israeli forces. They fired rockets at a house and they knew people were inside it. Two young men were killed and many others were wounded. It's obvious that the entire region will remain in a circle of violence until the occupation ends.
At least 52 Palestinians have been killed since late March, as Israel has intensified its aggression after a wave of deadly anti-Israel operations that led to the killing of Israeli soldiers. The Israeli military has never stopped its raids in the occupied West Bank. Such operations have often led to the death and injury of Palestinians, like what happened in Nablus. Regardless of how many people are killed or injured in the raids, Palestinians say resistance is their only option until they free the occupied territories. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Palestinian resistance groups have praised Bahrain's culture minister, who was fired for refusing to shake hands with the Israeli ambassador in Manama. Hamas resistance movement says that a move by Sheikha Mai bint Mohammed Al Khalifa is a true reflection of the Bahraini people's support for Palestinians. The Islamic Jihad movement also says that the minister's move was a bold decision in rejecting normalization with Israel. The Bahraini royal declined to shake the Israeli envoy's hand in a meeting hosted by the U.S. ambassador to Manama on June 16th. The king removed Sheikh Mai from office days later. Bahrain and the UAE signed normalization deals with Israel in 2020. The agreements triggered condemnations and mass protests across the Muslim world. The Russian Foreign Ministry says that Western-supplied weapons were destroyed in a strike on the southern Ukrainian port city of Odessa on Saturday. Sergei Lavrov's comments came a day after Moscow said that the attack hit a Ukrainian warship and a depot of anti-ship missiles. Ukrainian President Zelensky earlier said that the attack showed Russia failed to keep its promise as part of the UN-brokered grain deal. Odessa is a key Black Sea terminal for the export of Ukrainian grain. The attack came less than 24 hours after Russia and Ukraine agreed with the UN and Turkey on reopening the Black Sea ports for grain exports. Kiev has already confirmed that Russian strikes left the grain depots in the port intact. Sanctions by the United States and the European Union against Russia have not had the desired effect that the West was hoping for. Now Washington is trying to limit Moscow's profitability on its oil sales by putting a cap on the price. And that has received a harsh response from Russia. The Kremlin says it would have stopped selling its oil altogether. That's yet another sign of how Washington is taking action without considering the ramifications.
As the crisis in Ukraine lingers on, the United States and its allies appear to run out of measures to halt Russia. They have imposed various sanctions on Moscow. Russia's energy, banking, and financial sectors have been targeted by the West. But the punitive measures do not appear to have the intended results. Now the United States is proposing the idea of putting a price cap on Russia's oil.
This is more suicidal stuff from the West. I mean, one thing which this Western-centric, this US-centric, European-centric view of themselves as being indispensable parts of the world, I think is the main problem here, because they view themselves as the center of the universe, so to speak, in everything, in politics, economics, etc. However, they fail to understand that the world is rapidly changing.
The West is trying to limit the price of Russia's oil in order to deprive the country from the money it needs to run the war. The goal is said to be to set the price at a level that covers the marginal cost of production so that Russia would be encouraged to keep producing oil. The idea, which was first proposed by Washington, was agreed upon at the G7 summit back in June. Western countries plan to allow only those raw material and oil products whose value does not exceed the price cap. In reaction to the proposed idea, Russia has threatened that it would not export oil to the world market if a price cap is imposed. If these prices, which they are talking about, are lower than the costs for oil production, naturally, Russia will not ensure the supply of this oil to the world market, which means that we simply will not work at a negative profit. It's not yet clear whether Western nations have the capability to implement such a plan, but there are already warnings that this scheme may actually backfire.
Russia will not be sitting idle by when the U.S. goes ahead with its so-called price capping scheme. It has a plan of its own. Russia has announced it will create its own national oil pricing benchmark between March and July 2023. Washington's main goal is to prevent Russian oil sale to nations like China and India that refuse to join the sanctions drive.
Russia's president says the price cap would further propel global oil prices, and Security Council Deputy Chairman Dmitry Medvedev has warned that oil would be traded between $300 to $400 per barrel if the West goes through with the plan.
The European markets and the US markets are not the prime markets for Russian energy supplies. The prime markets are now Asia. And so they're out of step with what is happening in the world. And what this will do will exacerbate, as you noted, an already rather tenuous energy crisis, which is caused by, on the one hand, shortages of energy supplies, and on the other hand, costs of energy supplies. Because to cap it, who's going to sell it to the West under the production cost? No one, especially when the West treats them the way that they are treating them. So, I mean, it's going to be another shot in the foot for the US and its vassal and client states.
Some analysts are predicting that the scenario would be catastrophic for the US and the other group of seven countries. Market watchers have predicted that China and India, two key players in the Asia region, may not cooperate with the price cap. Western sanctions on Russia have already failed to deprive the country from its revenues. They have actually increased the money Moscow makes from its energy exports. Oil prices climbed to 14-year highs shortly after the war began on February 24.
I mean, it's incredibly self-destructive and also delusional kind of strategy run by the US, which is going to only but accelerate this global transformation away from this unipolar order towards a multipolar order.
They remain above $100 per barrel. According to other analysts, history shows that such attempts end in failure. The US tried to fix prices for oil in the 1970s, and the UK tried to set the forex prices in the 80s. All those attempts failed, and the prices boomed after those debacles.
Okay, moving on. Tunisians heading for polls to vote on a new constitution drafted by President Kais Saied and regarded as a referendum on his policies. Some 9 million out of Tunisia's 12 million population have registered to vote, and eyes are on the turnout. Opposition groups have called for a boycott. They're warning that a largely expected yes vote will give Saied absolute power, risking Tunisia's hard-won democracy. A year ago, Saied took full executive power after firing the government and dismissed the parliament. He pledged to hold a referendum to end what it called political deadlock in the North African country and its economic issues. He has achieved little during his one-year rule. Over to South Korea now, where activists and their supporters have gathered for a peace festival near the demilitarized zone. They want an end to the Korean War, and they want armistice replaced with a peace treaty, demanding politicians to do more. And the festival is held as the new South Korean president is boosting his country's alliance with the U.S. and planning joint military drills next month. Frank Smith reports.
South Korean peace activists gathered at Imjingak, a peace park near the border with North Korea, to call for an official declaration to end the 1950-53 Korean War. They also want the agreements made during previous inter-Korean summits to be upheld.
Let's join together, 80 million people for peace. Let's get together, people for peace around the world. Let's start today the great journey of marking the 70th anniversary of the armistice. Next year, the year of the end of the war and the first year of the peace agreement.
Peace activists traveled in groups from across South Korea to join the event. Former President Moon Jae-in had sought engagement with North Korea, but his push for an inter-Korean peace failed to materialize. Participants here want results.
We gathered here because everyone wants to keep a state of peace in the middle of this tension. We hope this will expand and be transmitted to the so-called politicians in South Korea and the world, so that peace can be achieved politically.
We believe that, after all, politicians have some responsibility for the Korean Peninsula issue, but our citizens need to show some of the world's political leaders that the general public wants an end to the Korean War.
The Korean peace appeal seeks 100 million signatures to deliver to the United Nations and the warring parties next year. New South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol is taking a hard line with North Korea, boosting the country's military and strengthening its alliance with the United States, with joint U.S.-South Korean military exercises planned for next month. Advocates for peace, like those gathered here today, have an uphill battle. Frank Smith, Imjingak, South Korea.
The Organization of Islamic Cooperation and Standing Committee on Scientific and Cooperation has awarded two Iranian scholars, and that in the course of ComStec 2022 for chemistry and also the best scientific book. Salman Kujuri was there.
The Organization of Islamic Cooperation Standing Committee on Scientific and Cooperation, ComStec of the OIC, has awarded two Iranian scholars as the winners of ComStec Lifetime Achievement Award in Chemistry 2021 and ComStec Award for Best Scientific Book. Ali Mousavi Movahedi of the Institute of Biochemistry and Biophysics from the University of Tehran won ComStec Lifetime Achievement Award in Chemistry 2021, and Ismail Qavanlu as Associate Professor of Shiraz University has won ComStec Award for Best Scientific Book.
I've been studying and working on the structures and the functions of proteins throughout my life. This is important because all human activities are actually done by proteins. As a result of 40 years of studies and research, I was honored to receive the ComStec Lifetime Achievement Award.
Our book is about nanostructures. It is the result of years of research on nanomechanics. A good thing about this book is its writing style, which can serve as a reference book for researchers and also a good educational book for students.
ComStec Awards are conferred biennially in basic sciences and in excellence in science and technology to recognize the outstanding research work carried out by scientists who are citizens of or working in OIC member states.
In 2021, more than 77,000 scientific articles were registered from Iran, and our country ranks first in the production of scientific articles among countries in the Muslim world and the region.
Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Closer, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. It's really hot in here, and eating ice cream really hits the spot. Fortunately, I have ice cream in the freezer. Yes. Today, Today, there are different brands of ice creams in the world, which have chain stores in most of the countries, and almost everyone is familiar with their name. It's interesting to know that we, in Iran, have a well-known traditional ice cream name, namely Akbarmashti ice cream. The delicious ice cream which I'm eating right now is from this brand. It tastes great. This ice cream dates back to nearly 80 years ago. Today we are going to visit Akbarmashti ice cream shop. Stay with me. Akbarmashti was the first Iranian who started the business of selling ice cream. His real name was Akbar Jafari Malayeri. He tried several different professions before starting an ice cream shop. At those times, he met a person who had learned about making ice cream in France. Akbarmashti, along with that man, opened the first ice cream shop in Tehran at Ray Street. The ice cream produced in this shop was completely compatible with the Iranian taste. He used clotted cream, rose water, and saffron for making this particular type of ice cream. In those days that refrigerator was not widely used, people used to dig deep holes in the earth, then poured ice gained from mountains in these holes and covered them. In the time of need through the ice, in the hot seasons, they took ice from the holes. Akbarmashti used to keep his ice cream cold in proximity of the ice which was gained in this way. Akbarmashti died at 97. His stepson, called Mohammad Malayeri, inherited his ice cream shop, who, by launching another branch of Akbarmashti ice cream shop at Tajrish Square in Tehran, has enlivened the name of this old Iranian ice cream brand. I am now at Tajrish Square, an old neighborhood located in northern Tehran. People are standing in a queue to buy ice cream. Of course, Akbarmashti ice cream. I'll stand in the queue in order to buy some ice cream. Then I'll talk to you about the vibes of this well-known ice cream shop. I am now inside Akbarmashti ice cream shop. The kind owner of this shop, Mr. Mohammad Malayeri, gave me the permission to take a close look at the corners of this shop. Well, there are pieces of old newspapers and magazines on the walls. These papers have published interesting information about this ice cream shop. This part of the shop is an attractive location for the customers who have heard about the reputation of Akbarmashti ice cream. On this wall, there is the picture of Mohammad Malayeri, known as Amir Mashti, standing beside Akbarmashti. And this is an amazing picture of Amir Mashti wearing academic dress. He has majored in law. He told me that one night he had a dream about his uncle, who had advised him to continue the profession of making and selling ice cream and enliven the name of Akbarmashti. Well, I'll buy some ice cream for myself And a lot more for my grandma, because she loves Akbarmashti ice cream. And who doesn't like such a delicious, fragrant saffron ice cream? Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
While the world continues to condemn Russia's special military operation against Ukraine, Russia provides its reasons for continuing that operation. In the latest, Russia has said that it had hit a Ukrainian warship and a weapons store in Odessa with its high-precision missiles. Two attacks have taken place in Odessa by Russia. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at the developments coming out of this conflict, which consists of continuing energy shortages for EU countries, and whether the U.S. provocative moves can prove to be one too many for Russia to counter-react with what the former Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev once said the U.S. may receive a Judgment Day response. Our guests for this edition of the Spotlight are Ray McGovern joins us. He's a former CIA analyst who joins us from Raleigh, North Carolina. Also joining us is Jeff Brown, radio host and journalist who joins us from Normandy. Welcome to you both.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let me first start with you, Ray McGovern, if I may. We're looking first at this incident that has happened twice in the port city of Odessa, where you have Russian, after signing that grain deal for wheat, et cetera, to target it. But it has said that the missiles did not hit the port's grain storage in the first incident and did not cause significant damage, and the other to actually have targeted what Russia has said is an area that held some U.S. weapons. Russia has its reasons. How do you see this strike by Russia, of which it's being blamed for now by the entire world practically?
Well, it's very hard to know. Russia does have its reasons. The question is whether those were ammo dumps and supplies and so forth. And we will not know that because we have no journalists worth the name in that part of Ukraine.
There's a backstory to this Green Deal, and that is that even though Russia has been blamed for preventing the export of grain, it was the mines that Ukraine laid in the access to Odessa that really made it impossible for the grain ships to be insured on the one hand, and then to go get the grain and bring it out. That has been resolved now. There's a channel that has been cleared of mines. The Russian foreign minister worked this out with the UN Secretary General 2 weeks ago, okay? Why doesn't the UN Secretary General acknowledge that? Well, mm-hmm. We all know why. So the deal is good, but it could have been done weeks ago if there was an agreement by the Ukrainians to clear the mines that they had laid in the approaches to Odessa.
Okay, let's take a look at the military aspect of this war, Jeff Brown, if we may, in terms of how things stand when you compare the Russian army versus the Ukrainian army. Based on just the latest, just a few aspects of the numbers, the Russian military, 771,000 active military personnel versus Ukraine's roughly 200,000. These are rough numbers. Russia's total tanks, 20,000. A little bit more than that, 20,050 versus 2,045 for the Ukrainian side. This is skewed heavily in favor of Russia to the point where it's kind of hard to really imagine Ukraine catching up when you have these kinds of numbers in favor of Russia. What kind of strategy could there then be in the Ukrainian officials' minds to continue this war?
The president of Russia, Vladimir Putin, recently said in a groundbreaking speech, and I wish we could talk about it, but we don't. This is not the time to do it. But he said that that NATO wants to defeat Russia, and he said, "Okay, go ahead and try. We haven't even really started." So all of this propaganda from the West about the Russians, they can't move and they can't advance and they, et cetera. They are using a little finger's worth of their military might. The U.S. and NATO thought that Russia was going to run out of high-precision missiles in 2 weeks. The Russians learned in World War II that you never run out of ammunition, and they never did, and they're not going to run out of ammunition now. This is not about Ukraine. This is about the West trying to save Western imperialism, global capitalism. This is way, way beyond Ukraine now. And it's pretty clear to me that Russia, they're taking their sweet time. The West thought that it was going to deplete Russian resources. Russia is basically toying with the West like a cat and a mouse, and they are the Russians are now depleting Western resources. And Shoigu, the Minister of Defense, was just in Donbass last week and said time to move further west and beyond Donbass to mm-hmm. get Ukrainians away from the Donbass so that their missiles can quit slaughtering innocent victims. Russia has already won, NATO has already lost, and Russia is going to bleed NATO dry until it has no more ammunition left.
Okay, well, that puts another aspect to this, Ray McGovern, if you agree, because I was going to ask you about the fact that what kind of goals would Russia have? They set out wanting that eastern part, but as our guests there indicated, their aspirations are not beyond that. But he put a twist in there, if I may call it that, that it wants to deplete the West, in particular the U.S., and then in turn, by default almost, EU countries' resources. Is that what Russia now intends to do, or maybe it has had that plan way before?
Well, there are three very important things that happened this past week, and I want to name them before we run out of time. One was the Iranian statement that they fully support Russia and its aims in Ukraine. Two was the Chinese foreign ministry statement saying the same thing. Real big events. The third one plays into what's going on the ground. Now, on the same day, oddly enough, Foreign Secretary Sergei Lavrov from Russia said, you know, we're going to expand our aims. We said we'd settle for Donetsk and Lugansk. No, no. We've got Zaporozhye, we've got other places farther to the west, and we're going to move ahead. And the reason we're going to move ahead and change our original designs or aims is because of the presence of HIMARS. Now, he singled out this rocket system by mentioning HIMARS. Now, here's the crux here. What's HIMARS? Well, that's a rocket system that has a range of about 50 miles. That's dangerous. Now, why did he mention that? Because the U.S. is giving HIMARS to the Ukrainians, and at the same time, on the same day, the Defense Secretary of the United States said, and I quote, when I heard the news that Russia was expanding its aims in Ukraine, I thought, well, I'll bet the Ukrainian leadership is really happy about how effective our HIMARS are and that they know how to use them. Now, nobody has put two and two together. In other words,
you can do it HIMARS, for us.
Lavrov is saying, is occasioning an expansion of Russian aims. And the Defense Secretary of the United States doesn't seem to realize the implications of this. He's more engaged in a rhetorical system as how good the Ukrainian leadership might feel. My friends who know a lot about military affairs say that HIMARS is no magic bullet. It's not going to change much, and it will encourage the Russians to go farther than I believe they intended to.
Well, yeah, HIMARS, I'm glad you explained that, Ray McGovern. Another thing that it does have, from what we understand here, is that it is, I think each has six GPS radars. It's very precision-guided in that respect. So Russia, in part, did have a reaction in terms of what you mentioned about Lavrov. Now, one of the things that maybe, Jeff Brown, maybe points to the fact that the U.S. and NATO together want this war to continue is perhaps the piece of news that came out, this was at this point a couple weeks old, how British forces have begun training Ukrainian soldiers to the tune of 10,000 of them in order to make sure that they will get the special military training, which obviously involves using the equipment that they have no idea how to use. Do you think, and that's going to take time, I'm guessing, when you train that many. Is that one of the reasons perhaps why the U.S. and NATO member countries want this war to continue at this point, to give them the a chance of trying to defeat Russia?
You're asking me?
Yes, yes. Jeff Brown, go ahead.
Well, NATO must be absolutely delusional to think that they're going to win this war. And it's, they think they're buying time. I think it's the Russians that are buying time. And they can train 100,000 people in London. And it's not going to change the outcome of what's going to happen in Ukraine. The Russians have applied a tiny percentage of their capability. They could bomb the Ministry of Defense and the nerve center of the Ukrainian army in Kiev with their precision missiles and hurt almost no one. They haven't even begun to really stretch things out here. And with Shoigu and, as Ray mentioned, Lavrov, you know, talking about moving further west, I mean, between all of us, I think in 5 years, Russia's going to have elite tank divisions on the borders with Romania, Hungary, Slovakia, and Poland. They're going to end up with the entire Ukrainian landmass because the West is simply not going to stop trying to destroy Russia failing the entire way, and the only way to stop it is to get to the EU border. And I think that's what will happen in the next 5 years. I think it's just a matter, it's just an eventuality, because the West will not stop.
Well, Ray McGovern, let me see what you think about what the former Medvedev has said in terms of the possibility of Crimea being attacked with these HIMARS weapons, because that's one of the things that was mentioned by Zelensky, of which he said that will ignite Judgment Day response. Judgment Day will come very fast and hard. It will be very difficult to hide. Can you please tell us what he means by Judgment Day?
Well, Medvedev has been the bad cop over the last several months. In other words, he's been given the task to issue pointed warnings. Now, as I mentioned, the HIMARS, for example, have a range of 50 miles. Now, you put them somewhere near Crimea, and they can do a lot of damage. They can't reach that bridge just yet unless they, well, no, I don't think they can have the range for that. But there are other rocket systems that the U.S. could provide. I'm not looking at a horizon of 5 years. I can't think in those terms. I'm thinking of a horizon of several months, and the key juncture is the U.S. midterm elections. By November, when the elections take place, the West is going to be losing profoundly. And there will be great pressure on Biden and his military to do something even worse than HIMARS. And that concerns me greatly, because if they escalate all the way to more advanced systems, which can go 200 miles, then Russia itself and that bridge that connects Russia with Crimea are in jeopardy. So this escalation, which I believe really started just this week on the 20th, when Lavrov said we're going farther, and the defense secretary of the United States said, the Ukrainians will be very happy to hear that because our weapons are working and that's why they're going farther. Well, how is he advising the American president? Is he telling Mr. Biden, hey, we got to be prepared for some really bad results here? When they go farther west, they're going to take Odessa. They may go as far as Moldova. And, this is a real problem. It's not a rhetorical exercise. Does he tell Biden that? I'm not sure he has the brains to do that. He's no smarter than Blinken, Secretary of State. And that's an invidious comparison.
Well, you have other statements made. For example, Jeff Brown, this question for you. Where Zelensky has promised Ukraine will not give up as the Russian invasion at this point is entering the 6 months. On the same day, which is today, you had the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine say, Washington will support Kiev for as long as it takes. So we're trying to figure out a timeline. Ray McGovern says a couple of months. I think you made a reference, Jeff Brown, to years. Do you really think it will take years?
Well, I said 5 years that the map will be changed in 5 years. And Ukraine will be reintegrated into the Russian Federation, where into the motherland where Ukraine was for centuries. And in fact, Russian Orthodox Christianity began in Crimea. So there's a lot of history with Russia there. I just don't see any other choice for Russia than to just keep pushing. I mean, they could do what the United States does, and flatten everybody and kill hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people, like they did in Iraq and Libya and what they're doing in Syria, et cetera. But they're trying to save civilian lives. They're trying to save civilian infrastructure. And since the Ukrainian Nazis put all of their personnel and equipment in churches and hospitals and apartment blocks and other sensitive sites, it really frustrates the Russians. They could roll to Lviv in a month or two if they wanted to wage war like the United States typically does, which is no regard for civilian life and no regard for mm-hmm. for infrastructure. So I don't, you know, I think Russia is thinking in years. I think they think that they know they are going to deplete NATO's weaponry. There's even Raytheon and the other manufacturers are saying it's going to take them 3, 4, 5 years to replace what's already been sent to Ukraine. How are they going to get all that back? And as far as Zelensky is concerned, he and his mafia crony that manipulates him like a puppet, they're making billions off of this thing. They are making billions, you know, raking money off of all of these arms and stuff coming into the country. So he loves what's going on because he's becoming even a bigger billionaire than he already is, and his mafia boss who works with him. So that's my assessment. I really hope Russia does roll all the way to the border of Poland, and because that's what it's going to take to bring Western Empire to its knees.
Mm-hmm. Ray McGovern, you have something to say, it seems like. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'd just like to comment on that and to warn that there could be what Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, warned just this week, a false flag, an unanticipated event, the kind of thing that changed things dramatically. I have in mind Zaporozhye, where there are many nuclear structures there. The Ukrainian Nazis are crazy. It is not beyond their capability or their intention, in my view, to strike one of those nuclear sites, to blame it on the Russians, and everything changes because now the Russians have attacked the nuclear facilities in Ukraine, and there are many of them. So I just warn that things could change rapidly. And Lavrov himself is warning in a very pointed way about these staged, he calls them, staged events to prevent the inexorable advance of the Russian army.
So what kind of response will we get, supposedly, if what you're speculating happens?
Well, that's just it. I have no confidence that Biden is up to responding to this. As a matter of fact, Lavrov himself has said in a recent interview, Biden is not in charge. Who's doing this are the top of the State Department and one or two people in the White House. They have ample proof of that because Biden has gone back on some of his promises, almost certainly due to pressure from the military-industrial complex, as well as State Department and one or two in the White House. So they have no confidence in Biden, neither do I. And this raises a really explosive situation if a unplanned or a false flag attack happens. And as I say, it doesn't have to be a nuclear thing. It could be all kinds of other things like chemical attacks, such as the ones that were staged in Syria.
Indeed. Well, there was another explosion that it kind of has been swept under the rug, but it is pretty noteworthy, and that is the treason that was noted inside the Ukrainian government, where President Volodymyr Zelensky dismissed the security chief and also the prosecutor general, and he said that there are roughly around 650 cases involving officials that are suspected of treason, aiding Russia. How big a deal is that, Jeff Brown?
You know, Zelensky, it's a sad commentary that this Nazi sympathizer is the most powerful leader in the Western world right now. It's tragic, and who knows? You know, there's so much corruption. There is so much money, you know, money laundering going on in Ukraine. Ukraine is the biggest washing machine for the West for money laundering. It could be he just needs to, you know, get some guys out who are not, you know, cooperating with him and putting in some of his cronies. I have no idea. And And it's also, you know, optics to look good, like he's trying, you know, he's trying to save Ukraine. And so I really can't say, and who knows. And whether they even left or not, it may have just been a psychological operation that he asked these guys to leave.
Let me cut you and give Ray McGovern a chance, and you could respond. And with that, that'll be the last question. Ray McGovern, go ahead.
I could easily catch this in terms of a staged event. Now, what happened was real. Okay, Lavrov himself, in his major statement this week, talked about Zelensky or whoever comes in to replace him, okay? Gratuitous remark. There's going to be someone coming in to replace him. And you know, the Russians are afraid of being blamed for that. They've avoided that so far. And Zelensky, please remember, is not his own man. He's pulled by strings in Washington and in Brussels, and also by the Azov people, the Nazis, against whom he has to be very, very afraid. Because he's vulnerable from both sides, the right and the left.
Thank you. We're going to end it there. Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst. Jeff Brown, thank you so much, radio host and journalist. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. For Mikhail Tapway and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, everyone. Dear sisters and brothers, welcome to IRB English Radio. This is Q&A, an Islamic belief, where we shed light on your main questions. I am Asma, your host for today's episode, and here with us, we have Brother Nur Muhammad, the scholar of religious studies. Assalamu alaikum, brother. Welcome to your home, and thank you for coming.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me, and I'm happy to be here.
It's actually a pleasure to be with you. Well, the Holy Book of Quran asserts that it has covered all subjects, as in verse number 89 of chapter Nahl, that says, "We have sent down to thee the book explaining all things as a guide," which literally means nothing has been left aside or neglected. But there were also, a lot of things that are not clearly mentioned throughout the Holy Book of Quran, mostly things that are the main components of modern age, for instance. For instance, technology. Doesn't it look paradoxical?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Let me, in the beginning, quote the exact verse of Noble Quran in chapter Nahl, verse number 89. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala said that وَنَزَّلْنَا عَلَيْكَ الْكِتَابَ تَبْيَانًا لِكُلِّ شَيْءٍ وَخُدًا وَرَحْمَةً وَبُشْرَى لِلْمُسْلِمِينَ. We have sent down to you a revelation, a book, which is a clarification of all things. And it is a guidance and blessing and glad tidings for all believers. You see that in this verse, not only this verse, we can add other verse of Noble Quran talking about this issue. For example, لا رتب ولا يابس إلا في كتاب مبين. Nor anything fresh or withered, but it is in the manifest book. If you look at the appearance of these verses of Noble Quran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wanted to say tibyanan li kulli shay, as clarification of all things. So what does it mean? Oh, for example, as you mentioned that maybe we do not have technology or some other modern issues in the verses of Noble Quran. You know that first of all, these verses that we understand and we want to interpret the verse of Noble Quran, actually, maybe we understand the appearance of the verse of Noble Quran. Okay? Mm-hmm. Dawahir al-Quran. We try to understand. Of course, maybe, you know, we cannot understand the deeper layers, which we call it bawatin or batnul ayah. Deeper layers of the, you know, meaning of the verse of Noble Quran. We cannot understand those meanings.
The layers behind the words that are there.
Exactly. Who can understand those, you know, deeper or in-depth layers of the verse of Noble Quran? These are only, the understanding of that is only limited to the infallible Ahlul Bayt. الرَّاسِخُونَ فِي الْعِلْمِ Those people who are strong in knowledge and who have the profound understanding of the verse of Noble Quran. These are pure progeny of Noble Prophet Muhammad and Ahlul Bayt. They can understand in depth meaning of the verse of Noble Quran. But we as ordinary people, of course, we can to some extent. Okay, what is a meaning of interpretation? Let me clarify this issue. The meaning of tafsir or interpretation means that you want to understand the intended meaning of the verse of Noble Quran. مَدَالِيلُ الْقُرْآنِ وَمَقَاصِدُهَا This is, you know, very technical. According to Allama Tabatabai and Tafsir al-Mizan, he said that, you know, interpretation of Noble Quran has different stages. First of all, to understand the intended meaning of that, of course, I do not want to go to the detailed description of the tafsir. And then you go to understand the maqasid al-Qur'an, which means the final purpose of the verse of Noble Qur'an. To some extent, maybe we were successful in understanding the meanings of the verse of Noble Qur'an. But beyond that, going to the in-depth meaning of the verse of Noble Qur'an, bawatin al-Qur'an, profound, you know, layers of the verse of Noble Quran, we have no way to that, okay? And this is limited only, as I mentioned, to the infallible Ahlul Bayt, alayhim wassalam. So, maybe in those in-depth meaning of the verses of Noble Quran, you can find many other sciences embedded into that, okay?
Yes.
Including, as you mentioned, mathematics, technology,
and science in general.
Science in general, maybe it has been embedded in that, but who can understand that? Who can extract those, you know, sciences from the verse of Noble Quran? Only infallible Ahlul Bayt.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Another understanding and another point is that you see that verses of Noble Quran mostly talking about those issues that ordinary human being cannot have a hand over it. For example, we have that in chapter Baqarah, verse 151, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala said that, وَيُعَلِّمُكُمْ مَا لَمْ تَكُونُوا تَعْلَمُونَ Noble Prophet Muhammad teaches you what you did not know. I want to say that many things human being can understand and can have a hand over it. Like, for example, sciences, you know, different sciences and, you know, different understanding of the human being. They can have some kind of, let's say, knowledge and, you know, some kind of understanding.
And discover.
And discover whatever, you know, some point to some extent, whatever related to the life of human being. Of course, you see the results of that. You see a lot of manufacturing, a lot of, let's say, technological issues, a lot of, you know, human sciences, which has been made by the mind and by the intellect of the human being. But Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, mostly in the verses of Noble Quran,